Hello again, my friends. And as a preface to this podcast number 5 of How to Get Away with Law, an unofficial podcast for the ABC hit show, How to Get Away with Murder, I work for a medical hospital, but I work in the administrative building, so you will hear background noises and sometimes ambulances. I apologize in advance. But now, we're going to start with the recap from the official ABC website for episode 105, We're Not Friends. Why is your penis on a dead girl's phone? That's the question Annalise posed to her husband about his relationship with Lila Stangard. Sam admits that he had an affair over the summer. He lied because he was afraid Annalise would think he hurt Lila. Sam forcefully tries to get his wife to stop yelling. Annalise pushes him away. She orders Sam to get out. Bonnie overhears what is happening. She exchanges a momentary look with Sam before he rushes off. Annalise interviews a young man, Ryan, who shot his police officer father to death. He couldn't take the constant abuse the guy was inflicting on his mother. She's glad he shot him. Things are better now that Dad is dead. The cops are painting Ryan as a sociopath. Laurel makes an emotional scorecard to chart the jurors. Annalise is dealt a severe blow when the judge refuses to allow the abuse claims to be introduced into trial. Laurel is happy to finally have a client she likes. She and the other students are assigned jurors to watch. As for the trial strategy, if a prosecution witness mentions Ryan's blog detailing the abuse, it can be entered into evidence. Thanks to some quick thinking by Laurel, that's exactly what happens. Later, Khan dispenses some advice. It involves jury nullification. Speaking of the jury, Connor is able to prove one member is biased. An alternate juror is put into the mix. Still, there's not enough to side in their favor. Ryan's mother testifies about the abuse she endured from her husband, but the prosecution's cross hurts. Laurel continues to keep track of every juror's reactions on her emotional scorecard. Later, she blows up Khan's offer to grab a bite to slip a juror knowledge about jury nullification. Frank catches her in the act. This gives Annalise an idea. She wants Frank to let the DA know that the jury has been tampered with. A mistrial is declared. The mistrial is good news for Ryan. He's no longer viewed as a sociopath, and his case is kicked to juvenile court. As for Laurel, the end of this case served as the beginning of her relationship with Frank. She kisses him, but doesn't sleep with him. She turns to Khan to satisfy her need for some more passionate action. In a flash forward, we see Frank calling Laurel. The reason? She's sleeping with him. Laurel answers the call to help establish an alibi about being at the bonfire. Frank is apologetic. He'll do whatever it takes to make things right between them. Laurel tells him it's too late, then she volunteers to be the one who returns the trophy to Asher. She calls on Frank for help with this task. 6 weeks earlier, a distraught Annalise drinks a lot. A now unemployed Nate doesn't believe she's not the one who told his boss about their affair. Annalise knows it was Bonnie. Sam admits to her that he skipped his Yale lecture because he feared Lila was going to hurt herself. Annalise brings Rebecca over to the house to see if she knows anything about Sam. She watches their chat via a video feed. Rebecca knows about the penis picture. She just doesn't know who it belongs to. Lila never used the guy's real name. She just referred to him as Mr. Darcy. Rebecca wonders what kind of person lies his way into jail to help his potentially murderous neighbor. She assures Wes that she's not a killer. She just likes making people feel uncomfortable. Rebecca clears out her apartment. She tells Wes via a phone call to look at the wallpaper at Annalise's place. It's a match for the one seen on Lila's phone. Wes confronts Annalise. He knows Sam is Mr. Darcy. Alrighty. And before I get into the review part of this podcast, I want to go ahead and go to the first law terms I want to get into. I thought since it was an integral part of this whole thing that we might as well get some more detail on it, and that is stealth juror, which is, well, basically what I'm going to do is just go ahead and read an article that I thought was pretty interesting. And it goes into more detail. It was written by Jerry Macron, who is a staff reporter of the Wall Street Journal. And it was actually posted July 31st, 2001, but I thought it was a pretty interesting read, so I'm going to go ahead and go with that. And the article is called Stealth Jurors Don't Disclose Bias, Then Seek to Sway Peers in Trial. Toward the end of a high-profile trial in Miami, jurors suggested that one of their colleagues write a book about the case. That got me thinking about it, recalls Jerry Blanton. I thought to myself, gee, you're a writer. This would be a tale worth telling. During jury deliberations, the community college English instructor pushed for convincing two prominent lawyers on charges of conspiring with the Cali drug cartel to import drugs and launder money. Mr. Blanton, several jurors recall, pressured the lone holdout to vote his way. He was presenting the prosecution's case, juror Thomas Butler says. 3 years later, Mr. Blanton's conduct is a key issue in the defendant's appeal. They argued that he tried to secure convictions to help sell the book he was thinking about writing. He had a hidden agenda, and it skewed what went on in the jury room, says Richard Strafer, a lawyer for one of the defendants. Mr. Blanton denies any conflict of interest. We were shocked, says Stephanie Parker, a lawyer at Jones Day Revis in Pogue, who represented R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Holdings Incorporated. He obviously had an agenda. Mr. John, a smoker who described himself as an exterior decorator with a military record, had been asked, along with other jurors, whether he had had an encounter with cancer, and he had failed to indicate that he had. He couldn't be reached for comment. Earlier this year, Sam Shipp managed to stay on a Chicago jury until deep into deliberations before confessing that his personal experience influenced his views. He was the lone holdout against convicting a man accused of murdering a Chicago police officer during a drug stakeout. 6 days into deliberations, the jury foreman sent the judge a note saying Mr. Shipp had been arrested by Chicago police on felony drug charges in 1999. The charges were dismissed after a preliminary hearing, but Mr. Shipp told his fellow jurors that he felt he was set up by the police, according to the note. The majority of jurors, the note said, feel that this experience has affected our chance for an open deliberation. In an interview, Cecil Horsky, who also served on the jury, says he kept saying this was a police conspiracy, that this is what police do, they plant drugs on people. Judge Dennis Porter declined to remove Mr. Shipp from the jury, and the case ended in a mistrial when Mr. Shipp held his ground. The defendant was retried and convicted in May after only 5 hours of deliberations. Mr. Shipp says he had planned to disclose his arrest during juror questioning, but was cut off by lawyers and court personnel. John Gorman, a spokesman for the Cook County State's Attorney's Office, maintains that the judge asked jurors if they had ever been charged with a crime, even if the charges were dismissed, and Mr. Shipp failed to come forward. Jurors rarely face prosecution for lying or failing to disclose bias during questioning because deception is hard to prove, and court officials don't want to discourage others from reporting for jury duty. Mr. Blanton's case is more ambiguous. 3 weeks after the jury convicted lawyers William Morin of Miami and Michael Abel of Washington, D.C. of racketeering and money laundering, Mr. Blanton sent his fellow jurors a letter. I have indeed begun writing a book about our adventure. It began. Now, the case spotlight what many jury consultants and lawyers say is a growing phenomenon. Motivated by a desire for fame or money, or by strong views of stealth jurors present themselves as impartial so they'll be chosen to sit on a jury or remain on a jury, and then try to sway other jurors during deliberations. Lawyers and trial consultants attribute the change to heightened court advantage since the O.J. Simpson trial. Getting seated for a particular trial, as the protagonist did in the John Grisham thriller Runaway Jury, is extremely difficult. But stealth jurors inaccurately present themselves as fair or hide some other conflict of interest, like a book writing plan. They occasionally confess to their biases after the fact, but otherwise they're almost impossible to spot, because a lot of this attitude is attitudinal and passive, says Rick Fuentes of Decision Quest Incorporated, a trial consultant. For every case we can verify some degree of deception, there are probably three more where it's there but we don't find it. In a recent Decision Quest survey of 163 lawyers who subscribed to the firm's newsletter, 60% said they think there are more stealth jurors today, and 2/3 said the increase has occurred over the past 5 years. Another Decision Quest survey of 1,000 adults shows a quarter can envision a situation where they would want to serve on a jury, and 14% would be willing to hide information about themselves to get on a high-profile case. The margin of error was plus or minus 3 percentage points. Lawyers say they try to be skeptical of prospective jurors who appear too eager during questioning or present themselves as models of fairness, but it was only after a confession by Edward John that lawyers in a Tampa, Florida tobacco trial last year discovered that he had failed to disclose that he had bladder cancer and his mother had died of cancer when he was a teenager. The case was a lawsuit against tobacco companies for the wrongful death of the plaintiff's wife, a 30-year smoker who had died of cancer. The day the jury was impaneled, juror Rosalie Kadelec says she told the state court judge that Mr. John had approached her and other jurors in a courthouse garage and said, "I lied, I have cancer," and it wasn't any of their business. The judge dismissed Mr. John from the jury before the trial started. In an interview, Mr. Blanton says he began thinking about the book when it was suggested by other jurors during a break in deliberations. But Mr. Butler, who also served on the jury, says that Mr. Blanton told him he was writing bits and pieces of a book during the trial. New York, New Jersey, and California bar jurors from selling their stories during a criminal trial or in California for 90 days after the verdict. Mr. Blanton says he didn't start writing until after the trial and abandoned the project after his sister got sick. He says he pushed for convictions only because the evidence was strong. Defense lawyers later asked the judge to hold a hearing about Mr. Blanton's conduct and to order a new trial, but the judge refused, though he later threw out the racketeering conviction. Prosecutors declined comment. Alrighty, after some of that detail, I'm going to go ahead into the review. So first up, so Annalise was Sam's affair against his first wife. It should not be a surprise that it did happen again. I mean, it's a common thread. If you're with somebody who was willing to cheat on the person they were with you, you have to expect that it could possibly happen to you, but you're hoping that it didn't, because you're hoping, well, the reason that this person cheated with me is because they actually felt strongly for me, so hopefully that strength of caring continues on, and I will be the last person they're with, but once a cheater could always be a cheater. Not always, but, you know, for the sake of good drama on TV, why the heck would you have them always be faithful to each other? It's not as fun on TV, but in real life, you know, don't be a cheater, kids. Now, the evidence of the evidence of Sam's penis on Lila's phone poses quite a conundrum for Annalise, a notably dirty attorney. I mean, this is the kind of stuff she would definitely use, of course, as we all know, on somebody if she was defending her client. But being put in this situation, it's got to play a big part in the story because, I mean, his penis was on her phone, and think about how you would feel, how I would feel if I saw my partner's naughty biz on somebody else's phone, especially somebody who had just been murdered. It's just rough, and how in the world is Annalise going to take this? I mean, it's obviously going to have some impact on the case. That's if she chooses to use it. What I really liked in the trial scenes was the line from Ryan and his lyrics that he did. I think it was for a talent show. And the line was, "I'm going to put some hot lead in my daddy's head." Clever and creative and super violent. But hey, when you're young and you're lashing out and your mom is being abused by your dad, especially a cop, then man, there's going to be some serious anger issues. And I had a history where my mom was abused, and I would have put some hot lead in my daddy's head, but gladly I didn't. She did get that divorce, though. And Rebecca, I love her line of, "I like making other people feel uncomfortable. It makes me feel better," which is kind of funny, because I like making people feel uncomfortable, but not to the rate that she did. I mean, she's over here confessing a murder because, of course, she was being coerced, and she just does a lot of really strange things to get a rise out of people. And hey, it's good drama. Now, with Nate gets fired, and thanks a lot to Bonnie. I mean, I think this is what made Nate tell the truth about Sam, that Sam did come back and didn't go through with his Yale lecturer, and he wasn't gone when Lila was killed. So, I mean, I feel like, once again, Nate was doing everything for Annalise, and I think he feels betrayed. He lost his job, and that's rough. That's really rough. And, I mean, I was waiting for this man to lash out finally. Like, what would it take for him to just stop just doing everything for Annalise and fend for himself and not do all these dirty things just because he has feelings for her? So, even though that sucks for, you know, our main character, I feel like it was about damn time Nate actually opened his mouth about it. Now, we've actually got more jury, law terms. This one would be the jury nullification. I'm going to go briefly into what that definition is, because, I mean, we got the gist of it, but and all of that, but I just want to get a little more detail in. Let's see. Jury nullification is the term given to the process where the jury of a criminal case acquits the defendant, regardless if he has broken the law in question. A jury's knowing a deliberate rejection of the evidence or refusal to apply the law, either because the jury wants to send a message about some social issue that is larger than the case itself, or because the result dictated by law is contrary to the jury's sense of justice, morality, or fairness. Jury nullification is a discretionary act and is not a legally sanctioned function of the jury. It is considered to be inconsistent with the jury's duty to return a verdict based solely on the law and the facts of the case. The jury does not have a right to nullification, and counsel is not permitted to present the concept of jury nullification to the jury. However, jury verdicts of acquittal are unassailable, even where the verdict is inconsistent with the weight of the evidence and instruction of the law. So, there's a little more detail on that. I had to look that one up because I was like, really? Is this something they can do? And I get caught in... For some odd reason, I was thinking, somehow, man, the jury's going to say, I got this paper that was telling me about jury nullification, and someone would be like, oh my goodness, we have to figure out who that is, and maybe they would have fingerprinted the paper, and Laurel should have used gloves, but maybe I was going a little too far with that. Sorry. All right. Annalise caught on to how Bonnie got the confession DVD that ended up getting Nate fired. And Annalise also thinks it was Bonnie protecting Sam, and that was the reason she did it, because maybe there's something with Bonnie and Sam, and there have been some awkward exchanges between Bonnie and Sam, so I'm wondering what's going on with that relationship. Now, Connor, when he gets the message from the lumberjack, as he calls him, it's used in court because this lumberjack was dumb enough to blab about Ryan in this case on Humper, of all things. Just, what an idiot. But it was a fun plot device. Okay, the defending attorney made a very good point that Ryan had his dad's service revolver, and he shot an unarmed man. There was no imminent threat the night Ryan shot his dad, which was, I mean, definitely a turning point in the show. It just brought on this hopelessness, but I thought it was actually, it made sense. Ryan had his dad's gun, so how is he going to be trying to shoot his mom at that time? Good point. Annalise tells Frank to tell the DA about the jury nullification, and he did it anonymously, and that was pretty awesome, but I want to see a little bit more detail on how the heck he was able to do that, what the process is, and, it caused a mistrial and juvenile court for Ryan. Whatever. This is also illegal. But I've got no respect for wife beaters, so whatever. Sorry, sir. Annalise finally decides to have all the men in Lila's life do a DNA test, which includes Sam. This may divert attention from Annalise knowing, I would think, because it would sound like she was just doing a DNA case to think of, you know, maybe Lila was sleeping with several people, maybe somebody that wasn't Griffin. And so this way it can come out that Sam slept with Lila, and Annalise can act like, oh man, I didn't even know that. I just got these tests, and unfortunately, this is what happened. So it was a clever move on her part. Laurel gets Frank to put back the statue. Anyone notice that Our Lady Justice wasn't holding the scales of justice? Now, that was in the flash forward that the, they show those balance scales so many damn times that I, you know, I'm surprised it took me until the second watch to realize, hey, it wasn't there. That's strange. So that's got to come up in the future, right? I mean, where are those scales at? And there's obvious alteration to the statue. Will anybody notice? Maybe prior students who've gotten the statue would notice that? Who knows? Rebecca left her apartment to skip Belle. She tells Wes not to trust Annalise. She tells him to look at the wallpaper in the bathroom. Once again, did Frank forget to lock the door because Wes just got to walk right on in to check that wallpaper? Annalise catches Wes and he tells her that he knows her husband is Mr. Darcy because the photo was taken at Annalise's house. And there you go. It's her favorite student flushing her out again. And you would wonder why she loves this kid so much. Maybe it's her son. Who knows? But seriously, I mean, he's found out so much. And maybe she's just, like I said, keeping her enemy close. Or her son close. Whatever way you want to think. And that is it for this episode. Please, guys, go ahead and send me some email, a tweet, or a Facebook comment so this isn't all just me talking, and I want to hear your input, where you think this is going, and anything you want to say. You can tweet at GetAwayWithLaw. You can also email your feedback, and you can do that whether you write it out or send a WAV file or MP3, MP4, whatever you would like to send. Via email, and you can do that at howtogetawaywithlaw@gmail.com. And on Facebook, you can just search out How to Get Away with Law and like the page. And until next time, guys, this is your host, Kim, ready for yet another case in How to Get Away with Murder.